Welcome back to The Horse Race, your weekly look at politics, policy, and elections in Massachusetts. I'm Steve Gazzella, president of the Massing Polling Group.
And I'm Stephanie Murray, author of the Politico Massachusetts Playbook.
We have so much big content today, so many big announcements, all important stuff.
But I think our most important announcement is our live event next week. So on March 4th, from 6 to 8 p.m. at WeWork in Boston, we're doing a co-live podcast with the Deep Democracy Pod, which is with Gina Christo and Wilnelia Rivera. And it's going to be so much fun.
That's going to be a great one. And people are signing up already. So check our social media for how to sign up for that. Definitely come. They're always a fun time, always a good audience. So that's the Wednesday after Super Tuesday.
Right. And so we'll be post-gaming Super Tuesday talking all about it. So if you need a place to talk about Super Tuesday and think about it, your friends are sick of hearing about it, come hang with us.
And of course, Super Tuesday is almost upon us. That's next week. And there's lots of big stuff that happens between now and then. Big nights of television, of course. There was the debate last night. And there's something that we really have to talk about that also happened last night. And that, of course, is
The Bachelor.
Of course. Anybody who listens to this pod knows that that is just of critical importance to
us. So, Steve, I have to ask you, after watching last night's debate, which of the candidates would you put on a two-on-one elimination date? And so for people who don't know, this is when the Bachelor or the Bachelorette, so in this case the American people, would take two of the contestants on a date, and they'd all go on the date, the three of them, and then there would be some drama and some fighting, and then the Bachelor or Bachelorette, or the American people in this case, would choose a candidate to leave behind and dump on the date.
So I feel like because – and then I'm going to ask you the same question because you brought it up. But I feel like if the idea is to take two people that have sort of noticeably negative chemistry on the date, then I think Jen Smith answered it right on Twitter, which is you'd want to take Mayor Pete Buttigieg and Senator Amy Klobuchar. Just watching them on the debate stage, I think you could expect –
I would want to see those, you know, like when they go off to the side and they do like the direct to camera interviews. I would like to hear what's going on inside both of their heads when they're sparring at the debates.
Okay, so what's your answer now? You brought it up.
I brought it up, but I have no answer. I would say I'd like to see Elizabeth Warren and Bernie Sanders go on a two-on-one date, just because I'm so focused on what both of them are doing in Massachusetts. And Bernie's really trying to kind of take over her turf here in Massachusetts and beat her here on Super Tuesday. So I'd like for them, they don't really criticize each other too much. I'd like to finally hear what they both think about what's going on and what's been going on for the past year.
And of course, Stephanie, you're a big fan of The Bachelor. So I have to ask you also, there's many ways that these decisions are made on The Bachelor, many ways that genuine love is discovered by the end of the season and two people who truly belong together are brought together. So,
Steve, I'm kind of sensing some sarcasm in your voice, doesn't make sense because everything you're saying is totally genuine.
I think it's all candid. It's all true. It's all real. But because we're already way down this rabbit hole and we're losing subscribers in droves, I have to ask what other parts of The Bachelor could potentially be part of the Democratic nomination process?
That's a great question. And I think – so I would say that these debates and then like the big kind of cattle call things that they do, like the fish fry or something like that, are kind of like the group dates. And I would really like to see all of the candidates do some sort of like obstacle course. You might remember earlier in the season they did like a pilot-themed – plane-themed obstacle course where they had to like get on these like little bikes and ride around. And I'd love to see which candidates would play by the rules and which ones would kind of cheat through the obstacle course and win. I have my guesses, but I don't know if I should say them on the pod.
Yeah, probably not. We'll just leave you all to guess. But anyway, having completed that very important task, we have to ask the perennial question, which is, what are we doing here today?
So we have somebody from the Boston Democratic Socialists of America on Bernie Sanders and a potential contested convention over the summer, and that's a little bit later. But before we get to that, we are so close to Super Tuesday, and I really just can't help talking about it. So we're going to talk about all things Massachusetts and beyond.
Sounds good. Well, let's get to it. Super Tuesday is less than a week away, when about a third of all delegates will be awarded as 14 states cast their ballots. Fortunately for us, we have a first-rate political analyst here to help us break things down. She's the president of the Horse Race Political Correspondents Association, two-time Horse Race Lifetime Achievement Award winner with distinction, and of course, also co-host of this podcast, Stephanie Murray.
Oh, Stephanie, Steve, that's so generous.
Let's talk Super Tuesday.
Let's go.
Thanks for joining us for this special segment. No, seriously, set the scene for us. What's about to happen in the next week?
So it's only been 2 weeks since New Hampshire voters voted in the primary. It feels like it was 4 years ago, and I have aged 100 years, but that was only 2 weeks ago. So we've had the Iowa caucuses, which were very muddled. We had the New Hampshire primary, which was a little more decisive. We had the Nevada caucuses, where Bernie Sanders did pretty well, and we're about to head to South Carolina, and then after that, Super Tuesday. So this is when a lot of the delegates are at play. So the early states, while they're important for kind of setting that trajectory and the momentum and kind of giving us a gauge of where things stand, Super Tuesday is really like the pot of gold for candidates looking for delegates to get to the convention. And that's really important this time around because there are still so many candidates. It's going to be important for people to rack up delegates instead of just winning states.
Yeah, that's right. That's what it's all about. It's not just how many states you've won. You don't get sort of a one or zero whether you win or lose. Delegates are apportioned basically if you clear 15% either statewide or in some cases in specific congressional districts, then you get delegates to bring with you to the convention and you need to rack up a certain number of delegates to win the convention. The 15% threshold actually turns out to be key because if there's, you know, six or seven candidates competing and they all have some support, then it makes it harder for each individual candidate to reach that 15% threshold. That's particularly important in this race because Bernie Sanders has either won or come very close to winning the first couple states. Iowa was a bit ambiguous, and it depends sort of how you count, whether you count popular vote or let's not even go there. Iowa caucuses were a mess.
He did well. We just used to, like, the men in black and, right.
We don't know really exactly how that one went. South Carolina, it looks like Joe Biden might win. But the reason that 15% threshold matters is because if Bernie Sanders gets maybe 25 or 26%, as he did in Iowa and as he did in New Hampshire, and everybody else divides up the rest, you might only get one other candidate who clears that 15% threshold. And then those two candidates end up dividing up all the state delegates, even if someone else got 13 or 14%. So that's something that we'll be keeping an eye on in all the Super Tuesday states. And it also means that Bernie Sanders could win a lot of delegates, even with only 25% of the vote.
And he's looking at going for the 91 delegates that we have here in Massachusetts. And of course, you know, he's running for president. He wants to win delegates. But don't forget, there is the senator from Massachusetts also running for president. And so what's been really interesting to me over the last week or two is that Bernie Sanders is really trying to stake out some turf here in Massachusetts and beat Elizabeth Warren. So he has a 4-day canvassing and music festival in Worcester. He's calling Bernie Palooza. He's having two back-to-back rallies where he'll be here in person in Springfield on Friday and Boston on Saturday. He's sending his surrogates like the author Naomi Klein or Ben and Jerry of the ice cream. And it's pretty serious because he's neck and neck in the polls with Elizabeth Warren. We saw a poll from UMass Lowell last week that had them. I think Bernie was at 21, Warren was at 20, and the margin of error was really wide there. So take it with a grain of salt. But she could really come in second to him in Massachusetts, which I think would be a big black eye for her campaign.
Absolutely. I mean, and we should also just note that primary polls historically haven't been as precise as general election polls. Like, we expect that there would be 4 or 5, 6 point differences in the polls, not just because of random statistical variation, but for a lot of reasons. I mean, one is that people make up their minds at the last minute in primaries, which if you've listened to this pod for a long time, you know, is something we talk about all the time. It's not like a general where Republicans mostly vote for Republicans and Democrats mostly for Democrats. You know, you've got six different candidates and people applying all kinds of different rules in their own head to figure out who to vote for. So even if at that moment when the Lowell poll was taken, if the election had been held that day, maybe it would have been accurate. But I think there's been 1,200 news cycles since then. I mean, I think it came out 4 days ago. So that's technically how many news cycles we've gone through. So I'd say, yes, lots of stuff could still happen. And that Sanders and Warren competition in Massachusetts, I think, is quite important.
And I just want to talk about Worcester, too, for a little bit. And I think there was some confusion, especially like among the national press, of like why he would be doing so much in Worcester. So I think the misconception about Worcester is that it's kind of all white and like the opposite of Boston and very working class. And while it's not as diverse as Boston, it's still 69% white. There's a growing Latino population there. And that's where Sanders did well in Nevada. He did really well with Latino voters. And there's also been kind of this thing called like a hipsterbia sprawl where like a lot of the suburbs around Worcester have been going through this hipsterbia effect, which I wish I could explain better. But there was a really great article in Mass Live about it a few days ago. So just kind of that that climate is really great for Sanders, especially with so many colleges. I think there are 9 colleges and universities in Worcester for Sanders. So it's a clever move by him. And I wonder if it'll pay off. I'm interested to see.
Yeah. And anywhere that there's lots of colleges, Sanders is, I think, could expect to do well. I mean, any poll we've looked at, we found younger voters certainly more for Sanders. But we do often see this confusion about Worcester City versus Worcester County and how they each vote. Worcester, the city, is like a blue island in a sea of red. You know, Worcester County is one of the most conservative voting areas in the whole state. Worcester City is one of the most liberal voting areas in the whole state. So there's this big distinction there. And sometimes I think when national analysts look at it, they just sort of think Worcester, it's sort of suburban. That's where the battle is. That's not where the battle is. Worcester is going to vote blue. Unless there's a massive blowout, Worcester will be blue in the general.
So switching gears a little bit, Steve, I wanted to get your take on early voting and the impact it's going to have on these candidates. I think something that kind of hamstringed Elizabeth Warren a little bit in Nevada was that the early voting, it had already happened by the time that she had that great debate performance in Nevada. But early voting is happening right now in Massachusetts, and she's been better in the debates than she was a few weeks ago. So do you think that people are going to see things that happen in the news cycle and vote on those bumps?
Yeah, I mean, the early voting is happening right now, just for those who haven't been following along. The thing we don't really know is how many people are doing it. So I talked to some people from Galvin's office earlier, and they said that just because of the way it gets entered, we actually won't really know turnout yet, because city clerks get the ballots, but they don't enter them at a uniform pace. So some might have entered them yesterday's vote yesterday. Some may enter the vote from yesterday and today, but not do it till tomorrow morning. So they have some numbers, but they don't really know exactly what they represent. We'll know by Monday morning. Secretary Bill Galvin will give a pre-election press conference and, from what I understand, be discussing some of the early vote numbers at that point. But until then, we don't really know turnout and how many people might be voting in what seems like a pretty favorable, you know, moment for Elizabeth Warren. She did have that good debate in Nevada. She has, I think, did fine in the debate last night. How she does this weekend in South Carolina, how the early vote does, how Massachusetts does, all those things I think her campaign will be looking at. I mean, we'll know a lot. We'll know a lot by the time we're meeting together next week on Wednesday at the live event. Sign up. We work 6 o'clock p.m. on Wednesday. We'll know a lot by then about how the race is shaping up and whether some of the other candidates, what their chances are.
Steve, does early voting usually drive up turnout, or does it just offer an opportunity for people who are already going to vote to vote? You know, we talked so much about turnout at the beginning of kind of this election cycle, and then we didn't really get that sky-high crazy turnout that some people were predicting or expecting. So do you think, I mean, does the early vote help that?
It hasn't nationally, there hasn't really been strong evidence that early voting creates a bonanza for turnout. And we also haven't really seen in the state so far a bonanza of turnout. The Bernie Sanders, we're going to create a revolution of turnout in this country or voter engagement. It's high. You know, it's 2008-ish high. It's hard to make perfectly direct comparisons because the population of each state is somewhat different. And there's no contest in the Republican side. So people can come over to the Democratic side that might normally vote Republican. So it's hard to make a direct comparison, but we're not seeing turnout just shooting up. We're not seeing that at this point. And it would surprise me if we saw that in Massachusetts, even with the early vote.
So, Steve, what about Michael Bloomberg, known Medford resident turned billionaire and New York City mayor? I mean, this is going to be the first time on Super Tuesday that he's even on the ballot. So what are you watching for after watching probably a gazillion television ads? You can't avoid them anywhere you go.
Absolutely. And mailers, too. We've actually gotten at least a handful of mailers. And I think he's the only one that's been mailing in Massachusetts, or the only one that I've gotten.
Oh, proof that Massachusetts rules everything. He sent a Massachusetts mailer to Michigan by mistake with a big, like, beware of nor'easters on it. There are no nor'easters in Michigan. It's landlocked.
Yeah, so we've got 3 Massachusetts candidates on the ballot. Medford native Michael Bloomberg, Bill Weld on the Republican side, and Elizabeth Warren. No, seriously, this is when we'll know if the $500 million that Bloomberg has spent is for real and sort of where that campaign is going. Just to remind people, he didn't really contest the first 4 states, didn't appear on the ballot. And now he said that he was going to do that and that he was going to put all of his time and energy and considerable monetary resources into Super Tuesday. So we'll know by, you know, when the polls close on Tuesday and as the votes are counted, whether that strategy was successful and whether he emerges as one of the leading alternatives to Bernie Sanders, or how many delegates he racks up and sort of where his campaign is going from there.
I guess we'll have to wait and see, but he's certainly edged out Tom Steyer in the billionaire presidential candidate lane.
That lane that we didn't really know about until this year. So speaking of Massachusetts candidates, also, of course, yesterday was the big thing that was everybody waiting for? I don't know. But the Boston Globe rolled out their endorsements and, drum roll,
they went with the hometown hero, Elizabeth Warren, which was kind of interesting because right before she got in 2018, a lot of Globe columnists were saying, don't do it, like, stay out, Elizabeth. But now they have come around and endorsed her.
And on the Republican side, another drum roll.
Bill Weld, another hometown hero.
So nothing from Medford native Michael Bloomberg. So just then to wrap up, of course, Elizabeth Warren, I think, is the one that the most observers here in Massachusetts will be keeping an eye on. You know, she's our hometown senator and has been running for the longest time and I think has a lot at stake with the results specifically in Massachusetts. You know, Michael Bloomberg, of course, has much at stake with results all across the country. But what things should we be keeping an eye on? Should listeners be keeping an eye on as the polls close in Massachusetts on Tuesday?
I'm watching Elizabeth Warren. It's just undeniable. If she can't win in Massachusetts, I think it's going to be tough for her to continue on. She'll certainly have the money to do it. But if your own home state prefers somebody else over you, I think it's going to be really tough. She didn't perform very well in Iowa after she had, you know, this big, everybody was talking about the powerful organization in Iowa. The same with New Hampshire. She didn't do so well. Nevada, same thing. South Carolina, I don't think they're expecting to win. So not that Massachusetts is the most important or the most delegate rich. I mean, obviously, it's the most important to us. But and she's not really saying that she's expecting to win. You know, she was talking about this with CBS News after the debate last night. And they asked her, you know, can you guarantee to us that you're going to win Massachusetts? And she didn't say yes. And she said, look, you know, I'm making my case all across the country. And they followed it up and they were like, so are you going to win? And she did not say yes or no. So I think that's
she called back to the Scott Brown contest, right?
That's right. Yes, she thanked Massachusetts voters for electing her over Scott Brown in 2012. And here's a friend of the pod raised this to me, which I found was kind of interesting. She doesn't really talk about being from Massachusetts or the state a lot on the stump. She's talking a lot more about Oklahoma. And I wonder if voters respond to that or if they care.
All right. So we'll see you all on Wednesday, I guess, of next week. And by then we'll know what's happened in all these contests. So do sign up for the live event.
Yes, you've got to come to the live pod. It's going to be so fun.
But for now, Stephanie Murray, president of the Lifetime, whatever the awards were I gave you at the beginning, thank you for joining us.
You did forget my real title, which is Bachelor Political Analyst, but I will let it slide this time.
That's a new one. And we're going to use that in the intro to every pod from now on.
After this weekend's Nevada caucuses, Vermont Senator Bernie Sanders is the leader in the Democratic presidential primary. But what if he ends up short of a majority of the delegates? This could lead to an often discussed possibility of a contested convention. And then what happens then? Sanders says whoever has the most pledged delegates should be the nominee, while the rest of the candidates are not so sure. So our next guest, who backs Sanders, is a member of the Boston Democratic Socialists of America. She wrote about the possibility of a contested convention for Jacobin Magazine, and she joins us remotely today. Beth Huang of the Boston DSA, thanks for coming in.
Great. Thanks for having me.
So this feels like a really specific possibility, but can you just kind of lay it out for folks who don't study the convention mechanics every day? What's the scenario that people are worried about here?
Sure. As of the past couple of weeks, 538 has shown that the chance of Sanders getting the nomination outright is usually about 2 in 5, and then the chance of no candidate heading into the Democratic National Convention with a majority. And I think both my hometown and Steve's hometown of Milwaukee is also about 2 in 5. That's because with so many moderates in the race, Sanders has a clear base of supporters because he's been so consistent on issues and has been fighting for working class people his entire career. And we want to ensure that if Sanders has a strong plurality of delegates, that the Democratic National Convention respects his strength and respects the will of the voters. a lot of people who are excited about Bernie would also be excited about Warren and other candidates. And also a lot of the support for Sanders comes from people who often are infrequent voters. So those are Latinx voters, that's young people, that's renters and more. And so he's been a candidate who has been speaking to the needs of working class people, and voters have been turning out for him. And we think that the Democratic National Convention should respect the will of the voters if they want to win in the November election.
So just to kind of clarify a little bit, specifically what we're talking about would be if Sanders were to go into the convention with the most delegates, but still less than half, basically what would happen then would be that there'd be the first ballot where all of the delegates that each candidate had earned would cast a ballot for their candidate. And then after that, on the second ballot, they would be unlocked, and also the superdelegates. So Democratic Party officials, elected officials from across the country then could cast ballots for whoever they wanted to. The thing that caught our eye, and that just based on how many retweets and likes it got that we wanted to talk specifically about, is that you tweeted, "We will primary every superdelegate and take mass direct action if the DNC steals the nomination from Bernie Sanders." We assume talking about that second ballot. So I wonder if you'd clarify a little bit what you're talking about there and sort of what the thinking is on that action specifically.
That's right. So in the scenario that my co-author Sam Lewis from the New York City Democratic Socialists of America and I lay out is that if Sanders heads into the Democratic National Convention with a plurality of delegates and is unable to secure the nomination on the first ballot, we, based off of the convention rules, in the second ballot, those 700 and some superdelegates will enter the contest. And we know that based off of who is a superdelegate, it's usually some combination of elected officials, some labor union officials, consultants, lobbyists, donors, and more. And we're suggesting a strategy that has a proven record of success in organizations like the Democratic Socialists of America of running insurgent candidates against incumbent, usually very establishment Democrats who have consistently prioritized corporate interests over the needs of working class people. And
Not their views that's bringing the primary challenge about. It would be the specific action of challenging Sanders, right? I mean, you're not talking about primarying someone with a specific issue profile. It's that exact action, right? That's what would prompt the primary that you're discussing here.
Yes. If the superdelegates hand the nomination to a candidate who does not enter the Democratic National Convention with a plurality of delegates, then we will take action in response to the superdelegates' action in stealing the nomination from Sanders.
So what's your thinking about Mike Bloomberg? Because this is kind of his exact strategy. He's been talking, or his advisors have been talking behind the scenes with folks who support Biden or maybe another moderate to try to kind of shore up that delegate support. So if it does go to a second round, he'll be a strong player.
Yeah, that's a great question. I think our strategy will remain the same, that we will react to to the actions of superdelegates who hand the nomination to someone who isn't Sanders, who doesn't enter the DNC with the largest number of delegates. I think that Bloomberg is a particularly interesting foil for Sanders, in that, you know, Bloomberg is basically buying the election for himself. I myself have received 5 pieces of mail from the Bloomberg campaign in the past week. And that's just in such stark contrast to the tens of millions of dollars that Sanders has raised from a grassroots donor army. And I think that the superdelegates handing the nomination to someone like Bloomberg at the cost of nominating Sanders is a recipe for demobilizing exactly the voters who need to turn out this November for Sanders to win. Again, that's low-income people, Latinx voters, young people, renters, and more. And I really believe that handing the nomination to someone like Bloomberg, who doesn't come into the nominating contest with the largest number of delegates, is just a recipe for getting Trump reelected.
So for people who aren't totally familiar with how this works, can you explain just kind of the mechanics of how it would work to primary superdelegates? Is this something that you do at the convention and make a difference, or is it something you punish them after? Like, how does it work? And how do you do it on a scale of 700?
Yeah, that's a great question. So it's a longer-term organizing strategy that honestly plays to the strengths of organizations like the Democratic Socialists of America. Just here locally, we have been extremely involved in campaigns like Mike Connolly's, Nika Elogardo's, and then at the local level, like J.T. Scott and Ben Uyenkampen's races for Somerville City Council, where we have consistently been able to challenge and defeat long-term establishment Democrats who are not serving the needs of working class people. We've been able to draw the contradictions between what a district and its residents say that they need and the actions of elected officials. Our counterparts in places actually across this country have been extremely successful in doing the same, most notably Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez. And so that's the playbook that we seek to use against any superdelegate who hands the nomination to someone who does not enter the DNC with a plurality of delegates.
So looking back to 2016, Bernie Sanders seemed to support the idea of a contested convention. Other than sort of the obvious self-interest, is there something different, fundamentally different about this contest than 2016?
Oh, for sure. There are far more than two viable candidates in 2020. And so that has changed the politics of the election a lot. And then also the political culture is very different in 2020 than it was in 2016. We have taken a strong turn away from the past 30 years of neoliberalism in the Democratic Party, where politicians like Bernie Sanders, Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez, and then locally like Mike Connolly, Nika Elogardo, and more have showed that there is a vision for a political, economic, and social system that supports people's needs instead of only putting profit over people.
So we've got time for one more question before we wrap it up, and I'm going to give you one that's maybe hard to say quickly, but the tactics that you propose when we're talking about this, of civil disobedience, mass protests, primary election challenges, I mean, candidates have been talking so much about unity and about supporting the nominee and above all, defeating Donald Trump. So how do you square those two things? I mean, do you think this will splinter the party more?
I think what we're exactly not proposing is the Dem exit strategy from 2016, which we think is a dead end. And the reason why we think that's a dead end is because the left is actually winning the contest for the hearts and minds of the Democratic Party right now. Sanders is seen most favorably of the pack of candidates right now, and it would be a dead end for the Democratic Socialist route to having governing power to give up on the Democratic Party. What we are saying, though, is that we want more contests within the Democratic Party for greater democracy in the party and also to continue winning this contest for the hearts and mind of the party. And so we actually think that there is a potential for greater unity if the DNC agrees to respect the will of the voters, particularly voters who are absolutely necessary for the Democrats to win in November 2020.
All right, we've got to leave it there. Beth Wong from the Boston Democratic Socialists of America, thanks so much for joining us.
Thanks so much for having me.
So that brings us to our favorite segment of the week, which typically is trivia, but today is the karaoke section of the Horse Race podcast.
That's right, Steve. Trivia is canceled. It is all about karaoke here in the Pod Bunker at Horse Race HQ.
And of course, this happened because last week, Stephanie and Jen did what I think is one of a kind, potentially Grammy winning performance of a debate night song.
It will never, ever change.
Debate night. And the feeling's right. Oh, it's debate night.
Oh, God.
And oh, what a night.
And after that, put the challenge out on Twitter for other people to send us their songs. And we're very much looking forward to Commonwealth Magazine reporter Sarah Betancourt, who said that she's going to bring her guitar and sing us a debate-themed song. We also got an awesome entry from a friend of the pod who, I don't know, Stephanie, how would you describe it?
He would prefer to remain nameless, but it is a parody to Old Town Road, and it's really funny, and I can't sing it without laughing, so I'll give you just a little bit of a taste. Some of the lyrics are, Amy's in the back, Staffers she attacked, Pete's here talking trash. Great line. And then Bloom was doing okay, but those NDAs. So if you can sing that in your head to the tune of Old Town Road, or we'll just play it here so you know what we're talking about.
I got the horses in the back. Horse stock is attached. Head is matted black. Got the boots black to match.
If you still have entries for that you'd like to put into this contest, please send them to us. But for now, that's all the time we have. I'm Steve Cazella, president of the Massing Polling Group.
And I'm Stephanie Murray, author of the Politico Massachusetts Playbook. Don't forget to rate our podcast, subscribe to it, write a review, all of that good stuff. Our excellent producer is Libby Gormley. And I think that Old Town Road should be the official song of this podcast now. My horse to the old town.